charge of supply and fortification for the war effort, that was more than a little ironic. But Carmella, Mage Lord Carmella now, had chosen Wilderhall for her temporary headquarters, mostly because of its proximity to so many years of records and its central and secure location. Carmella was not a particularly likable woman, largely because she had almost no social perceptions. Pentandra, of all people, had made friends with her, largely because she found Carmella's blunt perspective and lack of social grace refreshing. Carmella just doesn't fit in well among other women. They thought her rude and uncouth, unwilling to participate in their elaborate games of status. Personally, after years of working with her, I saw her attitude as an unwillingness to put up with extraneous factors, combined with a genuine lack of concern for what anyone else thought. The project was what was important. Carmella was cerebral and brutally honest, without the slightest bit of social pretension. That combination is bound to get you snickered at during parties, even by fellow war magi. That did make her an ideal candidate as head of her particular order, however, which is why I chose her for the position. Carmella was undistracted by rank or social position, as she had attacked the abstract problems of magical defense of the realm. She'd spent the last year organizing her order with efficiency and dedication, searching the kingdom for the very best defensive war magi to recruit. When I presented my plan to her, she didn't concern herself with the politics or the perils of the endeavor. She looked at it in purely practical terms of logistics and the potential opportunity to increase the defenses around the Penumbra.
"I've been petitioning His Majesty to invest in that quarter, as bare as it stands,"
she warned me over winter brandy that night in her hall.
"I didn't think anyone at the palace was reading my letters. A chain missing half its links serves no one."
"Yet keeping that sparse region garrisoned would be expensive," I pointed out. "The garrisons at Tudri and Verone alone costs the kingdom a fortune, and if Rab didn't need Anguin's support, I doubt he'd pay for it. The Iron Band is getting more expensive every month, and the inductees' creditors are howling about their losses. But these peeled towers I plan, they'll be a cost-effective defense, one I'd like in responsible hands. If your people can help build them, I'd like to put them in charge when we're done. They may be our best hope against the Gavanni in the Penumbra. Where manpower fails, magic may suffice."
"I think I have the magi to do it,"
she agreed cautiously, after a few contemplative sips.
"But I could use more stones."
Carmella was cold and calculating, but she was also as opportunistic as anyone else. She knew leverage when she saw it. "You'll get a new piece of Irionite for each tower you man, for the use of the commanders," I agreed reluctantly. I had a gracious plenty after the Alka Alon's gift, after all, and this was a worthy cause. Alkan Irionite too, better than Sherul's stock, by far. "But let's keep these assignments quiet, if you don't mind," I suggested, particularly in Wilderhall.
"You expect resistance?"
Carmella asked, surprised. "I'd be a fool not to," I agreed. "People aren't going to be happy with a couple of thousand of Kasari wandering through the Wilderlands. Important people. Let me deal with that. Just choose good people you can trust. People who can lead men and not lose their composure under duress, and who don't mind sitting on their asses for months on end, staring at the pretty scenery and waiting for something to happen."
"That shouldn't be too hard,"
she said, almost smiling.
"My folk would welcome the opportunity for quiet research, with Irionite. But as for manpower, my people tend to specialize. If you need builders, I have them. Guards? We don't have the kind of support troops we'd need for that kind of prolonged deployment," she admitted. "That's not really how I structured the Hessians."
"Which is why you'll be sharing jurisdiction with the Iron Band and local lords," I offered. "This will be a cooperative venture by necessity. They'll keep the towers provisioned, patrolled, and station small garrisons there. Your folk will keep them magically defended and alert the rest of the towers if there are incursions. They'll be watchtowers more than defensible positions," I pointed out. "They're not expected to sustain a prolonged attack."
"That begs the question of what defensible positions we'd have to retreat to,"
Carmella said, shaking her head.
Min, our defensive positions in the wilderlands are terrible. Tundri is a fine town, but it is far too close to the Penumbra, too far south, and doesn't extend a zone of protection beyond a day's ride. Megalin Castle is, too, for all practical purposes. All our forces are bunched up in the south, protecting Varon, in poorly placed locations for the war we face. I appreciate what we've been able to do with what we have, but our defensive posture in the region is terrible. This will help, she acknowledged, but it's no real answer.
What do you propose? I asked, swirling around the brandy in the glass. Carmella wouldn't bring up a problem like that unless she'd already considered a solution.
We need a real citadel, at least 100 miles back from the Penumbra. 200 would be better. Some place that can act as a real staging area, supply depot and hardened garrison. Something safe from dragon attacks, she added.
Yes, that would be lovely, I agreed. Dragons did horrible things to castles. Do you have a place in mind, or would we need to build from scratch? Building a major fortress was not cheap, easy, or quick, even with magic. I was building one, trust me. I know.
I need to study the matter more, she admitted, finishing her brandy. I worked a few jobs in that region right after Faris. I can think of 3 or 4 sites that might do, off the top of my head. Some already have castles on them, if you can call those moldy old wilderland shell keeps castles without giggling, she added disdainfully. The truth is, I won't know the right place until I see it. But give me until the end of the summer, and I'll find the right spot for the perfect defensive fortification. I just need you to see it built.
And you think that would help?
I think it's going to be absolutely essential if the Gavani come at us in strength again. And they will. After the thousands we lost in the initial invasion, and in the battles along the Timber Road, the whole of the Alshari Wilderlands is decimated. There isn't a single citadel left standing that could withstand a concerted assault, especially one with magic and dragons involved. The few people who are left in the wilderlands have no refuge, and they are the first line of defense against greater incursions deeper into our territory. These towers are nice, but we need a whopping big castle in the wilderlands, or we should probably just abandon the territory to the Gavani.
I take your point, I sighed. But it might be politically difficult to arrange at the moment. Convincing King Rad that he had to build something on the scale of Relancor or Darkfaller, out in the middle of nowhere, where there weren't any peasants to support it, was not going to be easy. He wanted to build palaces after the treaty, not castles.
I'm not interested in the politics, she declared unnecessarily. I'm concerned with the fact that Gilmora was just the beginning, and we need to be preparing. They may look like a bunch of wretched scrags, but the Gavani have been moving in a very methodical and strategic manner.
To what purpose? That's my question, I nodded, pouring us each more brandy. He hasn't attacked Varone, or done more than harass Tundri, when it's clear that he has the strategic advantage to do either or both. It wasn't an idle question. Carmella was a specialist in siege warfare, but that was based on her ability to think strategically in ways most other warriors did not. For her, war was a grand equation, and I needed her insights.
Clearly, the dead god isn't just sitting inside his hole, cowering in fear of us, she observed. He destroyed one of the greatest Alca-Alon citadels in a well-planned, highly coordinated effort. He's constantly improving the training and composition of his forces. Every army we face from them gets better. It gets bigger. We can throw magic at them all day, but at the end of the day, they're still getting better. And we're not, particularly. If we're going to win this war, we have to stop the defensive reaction and start taking some initiative. We have to start planning for a long struggle and preparing our defenses against the day Sharul decides to. That's how we have to do it.
I'll take your position under advisement, I promised, and I'll see if I can't work on the politics of the matter. But you can get me the War Magi for the effort.
If you can get me the stones, You bet your ass I can get you the War Magi. I'll get some teams put together. And I want to look over those Karshak plans of yours carefully. The little guys are adept at stonework, but they'll sacrifice practicality for aesthetics with the design. A beautiful tower with no privies, for example. If humans are to live in them, I need to see them. I need to build them. You'll get the chance. I'm thinking we'll end up building anywhere from 5 to 7 of them along the way. And when we're done, we'll have them installed with mirrors. Supply magic, defensive magic, signalling. We'll make them essays in the art of modern magical defence. She looked pleased in a way I'd never seen before. And you think the Gavani are just going to let you calmly build them without objection? They won't have time to object. Using magic and brute labour, I think we can get them built faster than they'll be able to respond. Each one can serve as a base to support the others. And we'll be using a lot of misdirection and feints from other quarters to keep their attention elsewhere. There are a lot of Gavani cantonments left in the Wilderlands, even behind the Penumbra, she warned. Our route will be well chosen to avoid the obvious threats and seek the safest course. In fact, I have people working on that even now, I said, thinking of the Alshari foot wizard, Fondaris. He continued to fill parchment after parchment with notes on the various strongholds and settlements he had travelled to in Alshar. He was nearing having a proposed route. Well, if I have your support, that's just about the last thing I need. Just about? What else do you need? I need to go see a man about some bread. I smiled. The nearest Alcan waypoint to the village of Talri-on-Burin was 40 miles away, downriver and inland 6 miles from the nearest real river port. I ended up buying a horse from a free peasant family and paid twice its worth for a saddle. With some magical help, the old nag got me to the port, where I sold her to another family for a pittance. Then I booked passage on a barge. I then magically propelled up the Burin when the pole men weren't looking. It took me all day, but I was able to get back home just before supper time. It had been a long time since I'd been back home to Talri, since my wedding, to be exact. The old village looked a little smaller than it once had, but Dad's 2 massive red ovens still loomed over the river like 2 giant breasts. Only the 3rd, smaller oven between them made the sight a little less titillating. An apprentice I didn't recognize was manning the shop front, as the last of the day's sales were made to tradesmen returning from their labours. My brother-in-law Gorsa was the first to recognise me, calling out my name. Then I was covered in female relatives and tears of joy. At last, after assuring everyone I and the rest of the family was alive and well, I finally sat down and managed to talk business with my father. "Dad, I need bread," I said. "A lot of it. The entire output from your ovens, daily, for 4 to 5 months. My father's eyes bulged. "That's a lot of bread, son," he said, shaking his head. "Are you feeding an army?"
"Of children," I said. Then I explained all about the Great March.
"I can pay you, of course," I finished. "Top rate. And I already have someone arranging supply. But this was the only place I could think of that could handle an order that big, so why not keep the business in the family?" "That's a lot of business," he said, shaking his head doubtfully. "Are you sure you know what you're doing, Min?"
"Nope," I assured him, "but it's what I can do. I need to feed these kids, and I can't do it while we're running. If I can get you to bake the bread and magically transport it to the field, then we cut down on our supply issues dramatically. That's food we don't carry, time we don't spend preparing it, and it has all sorts of other advantages. This is kind of essential to making it work. Otherwise, we're in the field for months longer than necessary, and every day of the journey becomes a risk."
"I'll help, of course, Minilin,"
my father agreed. "I can put everyone on it, but it will be expensive and disruptive to our other clients. But if you can pay for it, of course I want to help." I considered. "Would it help if I could get the goddess of baking to stop by and bless your ovens?" I offered. "Surely
I could impose on Brigga to help out one of her own deacons. My dad snorted.
I think I can handle something like this without it,
he laughed. Then he stopped and stared at me.
Wait, you were serious?
He asked in disbelief. I shrugged, cryptically. Spellmongering is odd work. You never know who's going to owe you a favor in this business.
Chapter 6 Brancy Mountain 2 weeks before the equinox, I had nearly all the important elements of my plan in place. Essentially, I wanted to do several things at once before anyone noticed exactly what I was doing. It helped that most of these things were also helpful to each other, even if the players did not always realize that. I suppose I could have revealed everything to everyone all at once, but I've usually found that invoking someone's self-interest, not their altruism, moves them to action more quickly. The final few pieces of my preparation were dependent upon the Kasari. I had done everything I could to make the way ready, but I had yet to meet with the elders of Brancy Mountain, or the 2,000 charges for whom I was taking responsibility. It was not an easy site to get to, even by magical means. Part of the problem was that the Alka Alon didn't have any waypoints convenient to the site. It was remote, even for the treefolk, and the magosphere did not lend itself to a natural waypoint anywhere nearby. I was about to change that. The closest Lady Italia could come was a waypoint about 70 miles away, in the desolate, flinty hills south of Brancy, deep in the penumbra. The problem was that those hills had been taken over by a broad confederation of tribal Gavani. Unlike the goblins concentrated around the former towns of Gans and Boval, who served the dark priests of the dead god as his loyal soldiery, the Gavani, who had taken to the hills northeast of their sacred valley, maintained a quasi-independence from Shurul's legions, even if they remained aligned. They were feral Gavani adhering to their tribal culture, while Shurul's priests twisted the bulk of the Gavani into something better able to withstand human swords. They were, in other words, rustic hicks and simpletons, despised by the advanced goblins, who had begun adopting many human affectations. They still used the ancient war clubs instead of iron swords. They still fought in tribal warrior bands, not regulated military units. And they still practiced a religion that honored deities other than Shurul. They were the dead god's shock troops, his common stock to be bred and used as needed. Otherwise, they were left to their flinty hills and marginal valleys, where the only ones to bother them were the Kasari. There were at least 30,000 tribal Gavani in the region, Arborn had told me, and they were breeding like flies. Thankfully, they were spread out in a few hundred small camps or caverns, with some occupying the few human fortifications they'd overwhelmed in the invasion, and some beginning to build their own crude strongholds. They tended to live as their ancestors did, in bands of 1 to 300, sometimes growing as large as 1,000. And they fought with each other constantly. The only thing they liked to kill more than each other was us. Appearing in the middle of such chaos was inviting trouble, I suppose, but it was simply the only way to do it. Lady Ithalia went through first, wearing her Humani-sized form and her new armor. The hilltop on which the waypoint exited was clear of goblins, she reported, and so she returned to Sevendor a moment later, for Dara, and Frightful. This was Dara's big day. While she had been schooling her Skyriders for weeks, preparing them for the journey, I needed Dara herself to complete this important task. It was a lot to ask of a 14-year-old, but then Dara had proven she was no average 14-year-old. When Lady Athalia brought her and her falcon through, Dara immediately transformed Frightful into her giant form, a 40-foot wingspan, and a beak the size of a battle axe. She quickly harnessed the bird for riding in the new rig Master Andalnam had enchanted for her. Then she got Frightful into the air bearing a package and a message from me. It was an important mission in a lot of ways, and I knew she was nervous. But Lady Italia told me she launched herself into the unknown fearlessly, intent on completing her mission. Dara flew 70 miles over unknown enemy territory,
almost 1,000 miles away from her home, to meet a group of barbaric tribesmen. Lady Ithalia guided her, mind to mind, using mountain tops for landmarks. 2 hours after she arrived in the Wilderlands, Dara was settling her massive bird on top of the central peak of Bransea Mountain, the second-largest settlement of Kasari. As soon as she landed, the unadvised and watchful Kasari was scrambling to contend with the 40-foot-long raptor, suddenly lighting on their sacred mountain. Dara took a waystone out of her pouch and buried it at a convenient clearing as soon as she landed. When she told me she'd done it, mind to mind, I activated the link and stepped through the waypoint with my retainers. The top of Bransea Mountain was misty and cool that morning, but achingly gorgeous. The largest peak of a knot of mountains, separate in form and nature from the nearby Mindens, Bransea Mountain possessed a wide plateau, with a nearly concentric ring of ridges around it. From the air, Dara told me, it almost looked like a lopsided rose, open on the south side. While the central plateau was bald and rocky, with only a few meadows and scrubby groves adorning it, the ridges that fell from its crown, like curly locks of hair, were heavily forested and green with life. At the base of the mountain was a long and slender sliver of Silver Lake, its shaded recesses covered in mists, while its sun-swept center shined up at us. The lake reached out in 5 or 6 different directions, and I could see the distant dots on its shores, where the Kasari had built their villages. South, beyond the lake and the hilltops, was a wide expanse of lower hills that were thickly covered in the tallest trees I'd ever seen. I'd heard about them, of course, the fabled Alshari redwoods, evergreens so tall and majestic that their tops swept the clouds, trees that reached 200 or even 300 feet, and whose massive trunks provided a strong wood of deep red hue. It was said one tree could provide all the lumber for one ship. But these trees were those most sacred to the nature-revering Kasari, and they protected every one of them from despoiling forces. The majestic variety grew in select places across northern Alshar, but nowhere did the redwoods grow larger or more robustly than the region around Bransea Mountain. For 70 miles to the west, and 120 miles to the northeast, ran the belt of trees so tall they blocked out the mountains behind them. They sat in the ridges above the flinty hills of the Wilderlands, and mocked the Wilderlords who claimed them below. The great redwood forest was largely within Kasari sacred lands, and the Kasari were very touchy about anyone even visiting the holy trees, much less cutting them down. In fact, they were historically important. Those trees had been the ultimate lure for Narasi settlement in the region. The theoretical mandate of the early Duchy of Alshar had extended from its well-defined original coastal boundaries to all the reaches of the north, to the very last banner flown or top the last tower manned. The Alshari had used that vague measure to extend their holdings from the southeastern ports of Enaltramar through the treacherous Westlands hill country into fertile Gilmora and beyond. In its most robust period, while neighbouring Castile and Rhemir were locked in an 80-year trade war, Alshar had quietly pushed its frontiers deep into the riverlands and farther into the Wilderlands. Even after they had started fighting for control of most of the Gilmoran cotton country, when the Dukes of Castile decided they wanted it, the Alshari Dukes continued funding expeditions into the Wilderlands to further the ostensible size of the realm, even if they didn't quite control it. Expeditions in search of iron, gold, and timber frequently pushed the frontiers of Alshar north. They built crappy little towers all over the place, and raised their banner to stake a legal claim to the territory, luring settlers there from the relatively easy life in the south, or from the riverlands, was hard. The remote and rugged territory was hard to farm and hard to clear. The rivers were mostly unnavigable. The endless forests were infested with wild tribes of men, goblins, and ferocious beasts no one had ever seen before. While there were a few rich iron deposits there, there really wasn't much other reason to invest in settling the region after claiming it. Until a young Duke of Alshar saw those magnificent, giant redwoods. Duke Targwyn was a sea lord, first and foremost, and he likely would have ignored the vast unpeopled territories of the Wilderlands he nominally ruled, just as most of his predecessors had. After the first loss of Gilmora to Castile, the Elshari Wilderlands was a mere token tribute in his ledgers, and a big space on the map. But then young Duke Targwyn was forced by his regent to get out of the capital and away from the politics of commerce, and enjoy himself in his more rustic estates. Assassins were afoot, and few in an Ultramar could be trusted. Duke Targwyn hated the idea. He was a seaman by inclination, and wanted nothing more than to see his reign marking the return of Alshari naval power after the disastrous Battle of the Red Waves. But after an unsuccessful dagger attack in his palace at Thalas, he had a change of heart. He went north, to ostensible safety. But while he hunted and hawked with the rustic Wilderlords, he was dreaming of caravels and frigates and warships of incredible scope. When he saw the Alshari redwoods, and realized what kind of ship could be built with the wood, Duke Targwyn became infatuated with the idea of harvesting the entire forest to build a fleet of ships so magnificent as to rival the living navies of the seafolk. He began issuing incentives for timbering and building the infrastructure required to move the vast lumber resource down to the coast, to where it could be useful. And he encouraged the landless lords, searching for fresh estates, to get him all the redwoods they could. The few redwoods south of the Kasari lands were harvested quickly enough, and the Duke's mighty floating castle, the famous Scarlet Heart, had a keel 180 feet long, made from a single great tree harvested 100 miles northwest of Tudri. It was as magnificent in its way as the tree it was made from. His plans for a fleet of giant ships of the class depended upon harvesting similar trees, and his vassals cast their covetous eyes on the Bransea range and the pristine redwood forests along its misty ridges. The Kasari of Bransea Mountain were resolute in defying their nominal lords. As the Alshari Wilderlords hacked their way toward the range through lesser forests, discovering new deposits of iron and a whole mess of Gavani who didn't want to leave, the Kasari dug in. The goblins were defeated and betrayed. Funny story there. But the Kasari fought the Wilderlords to a standstill in a bloody bush war. Eventually, Duke Targwyn died at sea aboard his flaming, floating castle in the middle of his Enultramar Bay, a victim of base rebellion. His son, Arguin, was far more interested in putting down the rebellious coastlords, who had sank half of his father's expensive fleet, and tried to promote the Count of Reims in his place. So the plans for the Grand Fleet were ended then. But the demand for the incredible trees in the mills to the south was always high. They fetched 5 times the price of other woods in the shipyards. Hundreds of the ancient giants were felled during the settlements. Yet no redwood within Kasari territory had been felled without their leave since the arrival of the Wilderlords. A tree that big can make a lot of arrows, and the Kasari didn't need a lot. They practice with bows from infancy, and hold contests between their cults for accuracy. They use laminated Wilderlands bows of their own design, powerful longbows that could fire a shaft 300 yards. Their stealthy rangers made every Wilderlord expedition of conquest into their territory an exercise in target practice. So landing a giant falcon on top of their sacred peak, scattering the numerous smaller birds who made their home there, and inciting omens aplenty, caught the attention of the Kasari elders quickly. I had only just escorted my party through the waypoint when the first of their keen-eyed scouts arrived at the top of the mountain. He hailed our arrival by taking a covered position behind a rock and drawing an arrow to his cheek nearly as fast as an Alka Alon. A second scout and then a third appeared in seconds, and within 30 heartbeats, more than 2 dozen Kasari archers had their bows trained on us. They barely made a noise in doing so. I'd chosen my other 2 apprentices to finish out our party, and they surprised me. Ordinarily, I'd expect mage blades to be drawn, or a war wand to be in hand, but neither of the lads reacted. Instead, they both slowly made a peculiar sign with their right hands. While that didn't cause the Kasari to lower their bows, it did cause them to relax somewhat. No one likes a jumpy archer, and nearly 30 made the situation tense. But Tyndall and Rondal knew what to do. I suppose the boy's quest with the Kasari taught them a few things about their culture, after all.
What are they doing?
Asked Dara, trying to keep frightful calm. The bird looked around warily at the dozens of Kasari warriors, who looked back at her intently.
Not getting shot,
I pointed out. Just keep her from eating anyone, and I don't think there will be a problem. I affected a serene smile while we waited, and calmly held a new staff I'd been puttering around with, the trek ahead of me in mind. It had none of the gaudy ornamentation of my official regalia, nor did it reek of deadly elegance, like Blizzard. It was more simply contrived for less martial purpose, fashioned like a common foot wizard's staff. But it wasn't, of course. I was the spellmonger, and I had a reputation to feed. It appeared utilitarian, but there were some powerful spells upon it. The 6-foot length of smoothed arcane ash was far in advance of the rods of the wizards of the roads. Trailblazer, as I called it, was built with enchantments and features designed to ease our long passage to Far Kasar. I'll get into that a bit more later. At that point, the artifact was barely halfway finished, and I'd brought it along because it wasn't as asinine as my formal stick or as threatening as my war staff. I'd worn a travel-ready version of my regular clothes, a rich tunic of 7-door green with a heavy leather jerkin over the top. Stout boots and thick hose under that, and my warmest cloak. You'd be surprised how chilly barren mountain tops above the tree line can be. I wore a dagger and some pouches, but no mage blade. Oh, I'd also had a sturdy pointed hat of green, studded with the snowflake of 7-door, made for the occasion, and cocked jauntily to one side. Instead of the 3-pointed design my trade allowed me, I'd kept the simple single point, though I added a wide brim for travelling. My apprentices wore rich variations of their own customary garb, though Dara had quickly donned a woolen gown over her skyriding gear. I had no idea where she had stowed it. We waited there, at Arrow Point, for nearly 15 minutes until someone of appropriate authority could be brought to speak to us. During that time, not one fletching twitched. Finally, one of the junior elders, if that makes any sense, came forward. An older man, his skin as dark as walnut and his brown wavy hair streaked with grey, walked nimbly up the slope to our perch, a staff of his own in his hand.
"I am Master Raslan," he said, without bowing. "I am the Watcher of the Northern Ways."
"Tell us your names," he said calmly, without threat, "and your business upon this sacred mountain." He didn't even blink at the sight of a giant falcon. "I am Minolan the Spellmonger," I offered, eschewing my titles of nobility. The Kasari weren't fond of lords in general and likely wouldn't find a river lord's title any more impressive than a wilder lord's, so why bother? Last year, the Kasari aided the kingdom in our war against the Gavani. For that great act of service, I have pledged to escort the youth of Bransea Mountain to Far Kasar. I am here to begin fulfilling that pledge. Captain Arborn has knowledge of me, I added. I'm pretty sure I sounded calm. That's hard when you're a whisper away from a 30-bow volley.
Arborn has indeed spoken of his friend the Spellmonger, Master Raslan said, stroking his great beard. We were hopeful that you would not betray your sworn word, as the Narasi have often done. It is good to know the sight of the greatest of our raptors has not dimmed when it comes to seeing a friend. It took me a moment to realize that he was speaking of Arborn, not the giant falcon looming overhead. The Kasari call their most accomplished warriors and rangers raptors, meaning they had completed the full complement of Kasari quests and skill achievements before their 20th birthday, to take their place as the elite among them. Personally, I felt the greatest of raptors was standing behind me and eyeing Master Raslan like a fat goat, but I suppose they can call their warriors whatever they wish. These are my apprentices, who will be assisting me in this great task, members of my household and most closely trusted of my advisers, Sir Tyndall and Sir Rondell, once of Beauval Vale, and Lady Dara of Westwood, the Hawk Maiden. My apprentices each bowed in turn. Actually, the boys turned the Kasari's strange sign into a kind of salute.
Dara just curtsied. The move impressed Master Aslan, whose eyes picked them out.
Tyndall and Rondell's names are known to us,
he said without emotion. You are all welcome as guests in the High Lodge, until such time as the Council of Masters will meet with you. I tried to stifle an audible sigh as 30 bows released their tension and their arrows disappeared into quivers. Master Aslan approached us more closely and regarded my two older apprentices carefully, before returning the same strange salute. The three dropped it together. The Kasari elder seemed to nod, as if coming to some decision, but he said nothing. He turned and led us down the path.
Master,
Dara asked, a little anxiously,
what was that about?
And can I reduce Frightful in size? I can handle a nervous bird, but it's a little easier when she can't accidentally fly off with someone.
I have no idea, I said, watching Tyndall and Rondell as they marched stiffly after Master Aslan.
And yes, go ahead and bring her back to normal. She's cheaper to feed that way.
The High Lodge was a small but incredibly well-built installation near the top of the wide, bald plateau. Indeed, it was in the highest buildable spot, from what I could see, looking down over the cascading valley and lake below, and over the tops of the redwoods in the distance. It was a small, square tower of local rock, 3 stories tall, narrowing gently to a simple, high-peaked, shingled roof. The lower level of the lodge was surrounded by smaller buildings of wood, each tended with great reverence and painted with great care with designs of woodland life.
The High Lodge is where the elders of our council meet to discuss our most important affairs, Master Aslan continued, once he had led us to the hall, where a fire was set within a massive stone fireplace, in front of which chairs had been placed. Today, you will meet with 4 of the 5 elders of the Bransi Kasari. Myself, Arganant, the Master of the Range, Erenthen, the Master of Cubs, Wolfden, the Master of Years, and Adana, Mistress of Health. The other masters have conferred with us, and we know of their thoughts in this matter. First, we must introduce you to our spirits, he said, as casually as if he was offering us wine. We then spent 20 minutes introducing ourselves to the carved wooden effigies of various animal spirits that decorated the lodge. I don't know how serious Master Aslan took the cultic ceremony, probably no more than any officiating priest, but he did seem a little more comfortable with strangers in the most secure depths of the Kasari retreat than before. The other masters filed in soon afterward, in no particular order and with no specific ceremony. They just walked in without attendants and took a seat. They all wore variations of the standard Kasari garb. Sturdy hemp-cloth tunic and short trousers, dyed a mottled green and embroidered with their lineage or something on the front and shoulders, heavy boots, and that little neck-cloth they all wore, fastened with a brooch at the throat. Some of them wore hats, brown or green wool felt, but they were utilitarian, not designed to designate any kind of special office or position. As far as I knew, 4 middle-aged Kasari had just wandered in off the mountain to speak to us. It was a surprisingly business-like meeting. After the Kasari elders had recited a prayer, or something, in their own strange language, distantly related to a dialect of ancient Perwanese, Pentandra had informed me, though they spoke Narasi and read and wrote in both languages well enough, they handed around a basket of nuts and dried fish, an odd but surprisingly pleasant dish, and cups of cool sassafras tea. Master Erenthen began by removing a sheaf of parchment from a pouch and spreading it in his lap. Spellmonger, we have 1,971 children enrolled on this journey.
He began, 1,221 of them are boys, all under 13 years of age, and 750 are girls, all under 14 years. There may be some additions or subtractions to the rolls as we get closer to the departure date. You are prepared to escort that many of our kin? He asked expectantly. If they are properly prepared and we have some order within the ranks, I agreed. I have taken what steps I can to guard the route southward once we leave the mountains.
I have assembled an excellent company of magi and priestesses of Brigga to serve as escorts and protectors, and Captain Arborn assured me that the Kasari would be lending their assistance and guidance for the first leg of the journey.
We have 500 rangers prepared to embark with you,
our gallant Master of the Range informed us. While he bore no weapon, save a knife at his belt, his silver brooch bore a symbol of a bow and sword. I took him to be in charge of the Kasari's security. To be honest, he looked more like a squint-eyed clerk than a leader of war, except for his profoundly self-assured attitude. Master Argarant wasn't in charge of the Kasari military strength because he was the greatest warrior, but because he knew what he was doing. They will escort most closely along the 70 miles through the edge of our frontiers, he continued, walking over to a beautifully made map of the region, carved unerringly into the wood of the panelling. He sketched the first leg of the journey with his finger. We can move more quickly if we leave our country and travel at the edge of the penumbra. We have ranger stations all along that route, guarding our borders that can support us at need. The greatest dangers will be from these four tribes, Bloodfoot, Handy, Fetid Claw, and Markarsh. They each have pickets and patrol north of the river. I think we can hire some mercenaries and arrange raids to draw off most of their warriors while our kin depart. He readjusted to inspect the far end of the map. Once we reach Otter's Point, at the bridge over the Osprey River, we come to the end of our lands. From here, the 500 rangers will continue with you until you reach the fords at Lamb's Foot. There, Spellmonger, 400 of our rangers will turn back, and you will be beyond our reach, he said, concerned. I remembered that section of country from my foot wizard Fundara's map and description of the route. Osprey Manor was a small holding that had once entertained the notion of cultivating large herds of the local breed of sheep for wool, being prized for its lightness and warmth in the markets of the south. The lord there had been well on his way to developing the industry when the invasion happened, and most of his sheep had been eaten. Osprey was now deep within the penumbra, and the tower, temple, and manor house that had once loomed over the Osprey River that gave the manor its name was likely long conquered, if not occupied. I was glad the rangers would be going at least that far with us.
As far as being prepared, the mistress of health informed me, at which point every Kasari at the table said in unison,
Beddich en Barod, before she continued. Our quartermaster has provided each child with a complete kit for the journey. A pack, boots, clothes, cloak, healing bag, knife, hatchet, flint, blanket roll, utensils, water skin, and accoutrements. She listed off in rapid-fire order.
In our culture, Mistress Sadana may have been a great abbess or high priestess. She seemed as dry as a twig, with a bush of graying brown hair and a long branch-like nose, but her owlish eyes were bright with energy.
You said you had secured well-trained priestesses to serve as caregivers?
Of the Order of Brigga, I supplied, as I sipped my tea. 30 at least. Mistress Sadana sniffed, as if she thought that was barely acceptable.
I will, of course, inspect their equipment and interview them before they leave, she warned me. I respect nuns, but I will have no foolishness. Now, have you secured supplies? The children can forage for a few days at a time, perhaps, but...
Foodstuffs are being secured even now by my men, I assured her. Basic, but hearty and wholesome. For as long as the journey takes, I pledged.
It should not take you more than 2 months,
Master Walfton, the aged master of years, croaked. I took him for a lawmaster or historian, one of those old men so soaked in the teachings of the Kasari that when their bodies betrayed them to infirmity, they were elevated for their wisdom.
Our folk have made the journey between the two reservations for centuries, and all routes are known. This many, even going through dangerous territory, should take no longer than that to come to sacred groves of Kasar. If no calamity should befall, he added warningly.
To help ensure against calamity,
I agreed, and to help speed our journey, the mage folk will be supplying a flight of giant birds, such as landed on the mountain. They bear skyriders of my folk to oversee the way.
Never has such a sight been seen on Brancee Mountain,
assured the historian, his toothless smile wide in wonder.
It was as if the great raptor spirits had come to visit us in person. A goodly omen. You have many such steeds?
8, my lord, Dara answered helpfully, in addition to Frightful. But they're hawks, mostly great Minden eagles, the kind that reside in these very peaks.
There are no lords in Kasari lands, Dara of Westwood, corrected the old sage without criticism. All Kasari are brothers, all Kasari are sisters. The spirit of the raptor is a powerful symbol to my people. They will welcome the thought that it is protecting our kin on their journey.
He nodded, satisfied. I was impressed. I'd sat in war councils before, campaigns before, and borne the endless and mostly pointless discussion they involved. Not much actually got done at them, as lords and captains played politics and vied for position. The Kasari's preparation continued long beyond where a conference of wilderlords would have taken it, however. Every detail was thought out ahead of time, every consideration taken. Comment and criticism was welcomed from all, without hurt feelings or recriminations. Notes were made and lists were taken. The Kasari would not move on until each point of the plan was understood and committed to writing. I sketched the route I'd chosen beyond the Osprey, south and farther east of the winding track that was called a road on the big wooden map. At Osprey Ford, it was decided, the children would be separated out into smaller groups, and the space between the assemblies was lengthened. There were a lot of reasons for that. For one, having 2,000 kids marching merrily along looks just like 2,000 infantry troops marching sullenly along in the distance. You just couldn't disguise the dust plume that would arise from that number, much less the fires needed to keep them warm and fed at night. Smaller groups would be easier to handle by the leaders, kick up less dust, attract less attention, and if one of them was attacked, the others could avoid the foes. I was really hoping that wouldn't be necessary, but even the Kasari faced that possibility with pragmatic resolve. Each group of 300 to 400 would be organized into troops, I was told. The Kasari would take care of that. More, they weren't treating it as an evacuation of refugees, or even a rushed resettlement. The children would be expected to continue their lessons in various subjects, from reading to tracking to needlework, while they marched. I couldn't imagine such a thing working. We were going to be pushing 20 miles a day, if I could help it, but the Kasari accepted it as a matter of course. We'd keep the groups spread out, with a trail-finding vanguard scouting ahead constantly, and a rear guard to pick up stragglers or wounded. That would be the most heavily guarded troop, I was informed, where the very youngest children would be escorted. I designated that my medical corps as well, where the few pack animals and small carts we would bring would reside. Once we made it down country to the lowlands of Osprey, I was hoping to secure at least a few horsemen to ride picket to our trek. Having giant raptors overhead were fearsome, certainly, but there was a lot of security in galloping horses and glittering lances. That brings us to weaponry, nodded the master of the range. While many of our youth have been trained in simple archery, we would not have them feel responsible for their own safety at their age. We have decided to provide hunting bows and quivers to every first in a troop, and we will ensure that they will be evenly spread amongst the trek, purely as a last defense. We expect them to be resourceful at that age, not hunters, and certainly not warriors. We will take all pains to avoid combat, I agreed, but I will have war magi attached to every troop to further ensure their safety and welfare. High magi of my order, each trained to fight as well as cast magic, and once we have descended to here, I said, pointing on one of the smaller maps in the room, at a pass through the northern hills, I will have men-at-arms from the military orders around the penumbra shielding us from here to Tudri, I pointed out. As long as we don't encounter any dragons,
We should be able to avoid any large group of Gavani we can't fight off. We continued discussing the trek until long after dark. At sunset, the Kasari stopped for a large meal. Delicious stuffed wild turkey with leeks from the lake, and mushrooms from the forest. But afterwards we continued talking around the great fireplace until the full moon was high in the sky. Finally, we had gone through almost everything we could think of. Preparation is the Kasari watchword, Beduch in Berod, and they wanted no thoughtless mistakes. They wanted every child who set out with us to find their way to their sacred groves in Kasar. When we were done, and I was far, far too sober for the hour, I bid our hosts farewell and conjured us back to Sevendor by waypoint. As soon as my apprentices and I arrived, I called for wine. I had a thirst that no sassafras tea could slake.
"How did it go?"
Alia asked, as I finally slid into our bed, our warm, comfortable, safe, familiar bed, and collapsed. "As well as I could have asked," I groaned. "Lunch at the top of a mountain in Alshar, threatened by 30 expert archers, in council all day with the most pleasant tribal elders, then back home in time for bed in the Riverlands. Typical day for the spellmonger."
"You poor thing,"
she cooed mockingly. "I had a meeting with the Sevendor Town Council, and then had to settle a dispute between Southridge and what's left of Genley over just who gets to mow where this year. And then I met with the builder who's designing the hall and discussed the plan." "Whatever you decide is fine," I muttered darkly into my pillow.
"I wasn't asking for your advice, my husband,"
she dismissed. "I merely wanted to inform you of my daunting day. Are you sure you want to go off into the wilderlands for 2 or 3 months, when you could be dealing with such weighty affairs at home?" "I'll be in contact with you by mirror every day," I pointed out. "And now that I can use the waypoints, I can even duck back for a visit if I need to. It won't be like going to battle. More like an extended excursion."
"I know, my husband,"
she assured me. "I don't fear for you, the way I do when you leave in your armor. But I am not foolish enough to believe that this journey is without danger, both in the field and if it succeeds." "I guess I haven't hidden that particularly well," I admitted. "But yes, if I don't do this just right, the whole thing could blow up in my face like a futzed spell. At worst, 2,000 Kasari children die. But succeeding brings its own problems."
"I'm sure you will get them all there safely, Min,"
she said. I desperately needed to hear that assurance right then.
"Nothing else matters much, as long as you could do that."
"Yeah, you're right," I sighed, settling back into my goose-down pillow. "I'm just taking 2,000 kids on a hike, through a depopulated, war-torn, goblin-infested wasteland. Counting on experimental and untested magic to feed them, a confederation of shaky allies to protect them, and a bunch of high-handed political maneuvering to keep anyone from noticing I'm doing it."
"What could possibly go wrong?"
she asked, playfully toying with my chest.
"Exactly,"
I said, nodding, drifting off to sleep. Chapter 7 Preparing My Staff. Assembling my personal traveling company for the trek proved challenging. My magical household would be attending, of course, all 3 apprentices, though I would be missing the 3 Alcan emissaries. In addition, I was taking along young Sir Festaren as my aide-de-camp. The young knight excelled at every task he'd been charged with as deputy castellan, and his magical ability to estimate had come in fiendishly handy in the most unexpected ways. Sire Kay spoke highly of Sir Festaren, and did not hesitate to turn over most of the mundane details of local business to him while he attended to baronial affairs. Lorcas wasn't coming, though he was used to a life of adventure, and he was great at solving problems, as well as being an adept war mage. But I needed him to be my troubleshooter for baronial issues while I was gone, contending with anything beyond the purely administrative that Sire Kay would handle. Similarly, Draenus was staying in Sevendor with Bannermore, Olmeg, and my other magical retainers. I would feel more secure out in the wilderlands if I knew things were well watched at home. I chose Tyndall to accompany the vanguard of the march, the Pathfinder troop. The Kasari had agreed that this would be made up of a smaller troop of older, more experienced boys, as well as a few raptors as escorts. I placed Rondal with the second troop, a larger group with better support equipment. The third troop I thought of as my headquarters troop, as it was the one I would be traveling with most of the time. As the central troop, it was larger yet, and had a full complement of rangers and scouts assigned to cover it. Since I'd also be moving around a bit, I wanted more magical coverage for that troop in my absence. It came from a very unexpected place. Pentandra.
I'll march with the third troop,
she offered, mind to mind, as I discussed the details with her one night. I was in my tower, and she was in her manor's solar, but we spoke as easily as if in the same room, and with far less attention to propriety, or tact.
What? You? Yes, me,
she shot back testily. I intend to go on this march with you as your aid, she told me confidently. If I'm to undertake the Kasari rites at the end of the summer, what better way to prove my worthiness to Arborn than by shepherding his brood across the countryside?
Penny, do you realize how long a trip this is going to be? And it won't be fun. At all. This is not a romantic excursion. This is...
Min, I know very well what this is, and I'm no stranger to discomfort. I don't like it. I despise it. I avoid it at all reasonable cost. But I can handle it. Do you not recall me humping through the wilderness in the middle of an invasion with a ragtag band of war magi and a bunch of nervous mercenaries? Ask your colleagues if I complained, she challenged.
I had no answer to that. In fact, I knew a few of our close friends had been aghast at how easily Pentandra had endured the rough conditions without complaint on that intrepid journey, a woman who had no qualms about beating a servant girl over a dirty spoon.
What about your business at the Order?
I asked cautiously.
I do most of it mind to mind already, she said casually. My staff handles the day-to-day business. My subordinates deal with any problems. They ask me if there are any emergencies. It's a cake job. Don't tell my boss.
If you don't tell anyone, I've mostly just been sending things to you. Does this mean we've successfully established a bureaucracy?
Enough of one that it probably won't fall apart while we're in the field. My protégé is managing well enough, and we can always run back to civilization when we need to. But count on me as your second in Troop 3.
Troop 4 was the construction troop, for lack of a better term. Carmella and the other Hessians would be travelling with that troop, eventually acquiring a pack train and even wagons, as we quickly built our string of peel forts across the edge of the penumbra. While Carmella wasn't the most adept at combat magic, the Hessians on the whole were able to handle themselves in a fight. Finally, Troop 5 was the medical troop, the rearguard. It was the most heavily defended and the most vulnerable, but someone had to make sure the sick and injured were tended. Lelwyn of Tears, a magical healer who had tended me at Megalyn Castle, and to whom I had given a witchstone, had volunteered to lead the medical tent. That was not adequate for defense, however, so I drafted a couple of local war magi who weren't doing anything more important. Landric of Honeyhall had been one of the first censorate war magi to drop his checkered cloak for life as a renegade high mage, and after his good and loyal service at the Battle of Timberwatch, he had been awarded title to the tidy little keep of Honeyhall, just outside the penumbra. He'd happily volunteered for service at both Cambria and up the Poros, earning more honour, and not a little bit of gold. But Mage Lord Landric was bored. When I extended the offer to get paid to scout the penumbra around his holding, he didn't hesitate. I paired him with my latest war mage candidate, Ormar the Shroudmaker. As dark and intimidating as his name was, however, he came by it honestly. His family members were morticians and embalmers in Wenshar, and he had indeed sewn hundreds of shrouds before he had discovered his Rajira and went to Alar Academy. He got drafted into the magical corps about the same time I did. It turned out that Ormar wasn't particularly impressive on the battlefield. He was a head shorter than I was, with an unkempt bush of coal-black hair surrounding the bushiest eyebrows I've seen outside of a car shack. A good war mage doesn't let a great nickname like the Shroudmaker go idle, no matter how mediocre you are. Ormart was a decent general war mage I'd found, and a good soldier.